It is Sunday, September 21st. I am your Football Scoop podcast backup quarterback, Zach Barnett. With me is Doug Samuels, John Bryce. Boys, let's get right into it. The day started 10 a.m. local time, 12 o'clock Eastern, with Big Noon in the Big 12 Conference taking center stage. Not the cleanest played football game, but a tough, entertaining football game, with Texas Tech establishing its dominance in the Big 12 Conference with a 24-point win in the mountains. What do we think of this one, Doug?
So the one thing I wanted to say after watching this game is I think Joey McGuire does not get enough credit for completely changing the DNA of Texas Tech. For decades, Texas Tech has been known as an explosive, offensive, juggernaut-type school that always struggled on defense. And Joey McGuire's been there a number of years now, and now they are known for defense. Like, that is such a hard thing to do in college football. And maybe it's a little bit easier now with NIL and booster money and that kind of stuff in play. But he deserves a ton of credit for, you know, having the nation's top run defense. And the way that the brand they play defensively is you've got to give Joey McGuire and his staff a ton of credit for changing the DNA of Texas Tech football.
Well, I love that point, Doug, and felt very similarly about I wasn't going to necessarily specifically talk about the Tech defense as much as I was going to say it's been remade into a complete team. And but when you look at that defense and when you watch that defense yesterday, it's not only physical, but there's a lot of speed on that defense. And we have not seen that out of Texas Tech. And Utah is not an offensive juggernaut by any means. But again, like, I'll always defer to the coaches who are so exponentially smarter than me, especially a guy like Kyle Whittingham, who's done it forever. And he has gone on record as saying he thinks he has two NFL offensive linemen starting at tackle for him. So Texas Tech did that on the road to a team that's own head coach says has two NFL offensive linemen starting at the two tackle positions. And the game was close, close-ish in the second half, but Texas Tech controlled it the whole day and then completely pulled away. And I'd been pretty high on Utah, in part because I'd listened to Kyle Whittingham and was zoomed in on the press conference the day he said those things. But I'd felt that they might be the best team in the Big 12. And I think we saw firsthand with that kind of win yesterday that Texas Tech is the best team in the Big 12.
Yeah, I think that's undebatable at this point. And you can make an argument that Texas Tech defense continues its status as the best individual unit. So coming in, they had the number one rush defense in the country. And I don't know what the numbers say, but it's still the number one rush defense in the country. Utah ran the ball 31 times for 101 yards. And even more impressive, they had a long of eight. Their long run, Utah's long run, was 8 yards. Through the air, that Utah had a 44-yard completion. They had another long completion that was called back by a penalty. But outside of that, their long completion was 12 yards. So to your point, Doug, being able to have the resources to flip your roster the way they did is one thing, but actually getting those guys to play together, play cohesive football, credit to Joey McGuire, and also credit to Shiel Wood, his defensive coordinator hire from Houston. I think you have to say at this point is a front runner for the Broyles Award, front runner for the Football Scoop Defensive Coordinator of the Year Award, for going on the road against a defense that can be, or an offense that can be tough to prepare for, and they looked extremely well prepared. And they also they turned that game early with two punch-outs of the football.
Yeah, and that's coaching when like, and we saw a punch-out in another game I know that we're about to talk about, but when you see them do that, that just is translating what they're having coached on the practice field onto the game field. And you've got to think as coaches, I know Doug knows this better than we do, although you coach as well, Zach, when you see a kid translate it from the practice field to the game field, that's coaching at its finest, in my opinion.
So let's stay in the noon window as Clemson. What do you even say at this point? You thought if this team is playing below its talent level, you thought that loss to Georgia Tech and the chance to go back home would wake them up. And if this is an awoken Clemson team, is this team going to get to six wins?
Well, what I would say is, what do you even say? I would just refer you to my Twitter, because I said yesterday, man, Clemson must be exhausted by all this winning, because Dabo Swinney went on his thin-skinned rant earlier in the week to say, if Clemson's tired of winning, they can send me on my way. Well, Clemson's tired of losing, and they've already lost four, which I think I saw was the program's worst start to a season since 2004. And to Dabo's credit, it's easily the worst start of his tenure. But Clemson is not Clemson. Cade Klubnik is the guy who looks like an Adonis and plays like a statue. So, Doug, your thoughts.
I mean, for Dabo, worst start to his career, starting off at 1-3, right? But I think when it comes to guys like Dabo that have built a program into national prominence and put them in the, you know, he rattled off his own resume in his defense earlier this week, taking team to the playoffs 7 out of 10 years, winning the ACC 8 out of 10 years or whatever it was. He deserves the opportunity to get the program back on track. Like he's probably going to have to reevaluate their approach to the transfer portal, which I know we've talked about a number of times on the pod, but he absolutely deserves a chance to get this program back on track. Whether they make a bowl game or they don't, he was plucked from relative obscurity as the receivers coach to step in and has done an admirable job making Clemson the crown jewel of the ACC. So he deserves the opportunity to get this program back on track. On the flip side, I don't think, for me personally, there is a coach in college football I would rather play for than Fran Brown. Like, Fran Brown tells it like it is. He had an interview earlier, early last week, where he was talking about, you know, his kids getting plucked or getting pushed to go into the transfer portal. And Fran Brown's like, you better hope I don't see you around, because I'm going to ask. I ain't no B word. Right. And that's a dude you want to play for, like a little fiery, still looks like and feels like he could play some college snaps. Like he's a dude that a lot of people are going to want to play for. And I know was raised on the streets of Camden. He's a Syracuse guy, but his brand of football is going to be sought after this offseason. And they play great offense. Jeff Nixon, the offensive coordinator, they do an awesome job of making explosive plays, and their receivers play unbelievable. Their quarterback has led the country in passing for the past 2 years, two different guys, and Angeli went down this past week and is going to be done for a few weeks. But the brand of football they play is tough and explosive, and that's going to be really attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah, their offense has been really, really good. Is Angeli just a few weeks, or is it an Achilles injury, Doug? I wasn't sure. Expected
to miss a couple weeks is the last thing that I've seen.
Okay, well, that would be very good news. And I think we all discussed going into this season that Syracuse had one of the toughest schedules anywhere in college football. I mean, when you think about it, they've already obviously played Tennessee and Atlanta and Clemson at Clemson. So what Fran Brown is doing, I could not agree more. He's going to be one of the it names in the coaching carousel that technically started spinning last Sunday morning. So, yeah, Fran Brown, Syracuse should enjoy him. And I'm sure that the Orange leaders will do everything they can to try and keep him. I don't think it's going to matter. It's impossible to sustain success at Syracuse, and Fran Brown is proving that he breeds success as a head coach.
So one number that jumps out at me from that game, Clemson had 82 plays, 29 first downs, 503 yards, and turned that into only 21 points. And that, it seems like coming into the season, it was there's a lot of optimism for this team because they had a lot of high-level draft picks, but it seems like consistently the whole does not add up to the sum of the parts. And that was evident, I thought, because Syracuse and Fran Brown with 13 career wins looked like the better coach team than Dabo and his 181 career wins.
They were definitely the more aggressive team. I don't think there's any doubt in my mind about that. And then I also think that, Clemson probably had grown weary of all the negativity leading into the week and probably came out fired up, and then Syracuse just extinguished that fire. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more on Syracuse being more aggressive and Clemson not remotely equaling the talent that it has, not even coming close. When you and look, Klubnik's draft stock, I think, drops more and more each week, but there's still Clemson still feels like it has NFL receivers, NFL offensive linemen, and a bunch of NFL dudes on defense, and yet here they are.
Let's stay in the noon window. How did Arkansas lose to Memphis?
I mean, that's a great question. I said on the podcast last week, when we were talking on Thursday, like, I didn't think Memphis had the dudes to stack up with a mid to low tier SEC team, and Memphis got some big stops when they needed big stops. Like, they had some players step up and play in the moment, and Sam Pittman, I think, drops to like 7-18 or something in one score games, just not good at all. And then when you ask what do you got to do to turn it around, he didn't have an answer, which that is the peak of frustration for a coach and a presser to be asked a question and kind of turn it around and be like, hey, I'm looking for suggestions. That explains the frustration in Arkansas right now.
Yeah, and the Hogs host Notre Dame this coming Saturday, and the SEC did Arkansas no favors long before the season started by designating it an 11 a.m. local time kickoff. So Arkansas is going to be 2-2. It's got now an 11 a.m. kickoff coming off consecutive losses. Any home field advantage that it could have possibly whipped up to call the Hogs into a frenzy at night will be non-existent. I've known Sam Pittman since he was the O-line coach at Tennessee. He's one of the really good dudes in Ball, but you have to feel his days at Arkansas are numbered. And you ask how they lost, Zach. We just talked about, you made the great point on Texas Tech with two punch-out fumbles early against Utah. That's how Arkansas lost the game. It was a Memphis punch-out fumble, and they recovered it. The problem is that's an effort play by Memphis that was better than the effort play by the Arkansas tailback lunging for extra yardage. They didn't need to. They should have been, at that point, either call a play to get a touchdown or keep the ball in the center of the field and have your quarterback kneel three times and kick a field goal that was only going to be about 3 yards longer than a PAT, and you were dead center of the field. You didn't need a touchdown. You were down 1 point. Memphis was having to use all of its timeouts just to stop the clock. And you, I didn't understand the coaching right there. It's very rare that I look at a play like that and think, well, that's coaching. But I do have to fault the Arkansas coaching in that loss. Both because they were in that point to need a late field goal. Remember, they were up 18. That's the largest comeback Memphis has ever had in that late of a game to win. And then they do it against an SEC power conference opponent. And again, I just point to coaching. I thought it was very poor coaching all around, whether that was Bobby Petrino insisting they run those plays or what. But there's nervous people in Fayetteville. I know that for a fact because I've talked to some of them. So just as much as there's really nervous people in Gainesville as well.
I mean, you look at the margins where Arkansas could be if just a couple things are differently where they are right now. So you mentioned the fumble. They also had an opportunity last week to take a late lead at Ole Miss and fumble that away. So you'd be 4-0, ranked 18th, something like that. Going into a huge home game with Notre Dame, and now it's like Notre Dame looks like the last stand, and it seems like the landslide has already started on Sam Pittman. So that's college football. So let's go to 2:30.
Real quick, oh, Zach. Real quick. I think while we point the fingers at maybe some bad calls or coaches on the hot seat, the American deserves, or whatever the heck we're supposed to refer to them now. I don't even know. They deserve their flowers, right? They've beaten SEC program, Big Ten program. I think they've taken down at least all the Power Fours at least once. So they better have a banner week celebrating their wins over the last several weeks and make sure everyone knows what to call them by this time next week.
Yeah, and Ryan Silverfield, and we know that Florida State team fizzled last year, but Ryan Silverfield at Memphis leading them to an 11-win season last year that included wins against Florida State, West Virginia, and Tulane, now already has another SEC pelt on the wall this year with the win against Arkansas. Ryan Silverfield's another coach I fully expect that we hear a lot about in the mix for some jobs as this fall continues to unfold.
Let's go to 230. Oklahoma 24, Auburn 17. A great college football game. I hate to start with the officials, but I feel like I'd be dishonest starting the discussion anywhere but the officials. John, what do you take away? Yeah,
we wrote about it on Football Scoop. It's there right now if you're listening to the pod and want to see it. SEC office weighs in on Auburn, Oklahoma officiating issues. I would note both teams were heavily penalized yesterday. So Auburn had 13 flags against it for 80-plus yards. Oklahoma actually had 9 flags for 99 yards, I believe. So there was no lack of laundry on the field yesterday, but there was no laundry on the field for one of the key moments in the game, and that was the fake substitution touchdown play where the guy had to make a tougher catch than it should have been because the ball was a little high, but he was all by his lonesome, split out by the left sideline. Auburn thought he was leaving the field because he had participated in the previous play. The SEC has issued its statement basically saying that's completely illegal. It's not allowed. And trust us, there's going to be consequences, but that's all you're going to hear. Appropriate accountability will be applied without additional comment. That's a whole other podcast for me. Like, and I've got friends who are officials at the college and high school levels, and hopefully they continue to be my friend. But we expect 18-year-old kids. CJ Carr has talked, I think, after every single Notre Dame game, and he's a first-year starting quarterback in the SEC who's 19 years old, but we never hear from the officials. Like, the crew chief should have to answer to this. These guys are making more money also than ever before. SEC and Big Ten officials, I think, make around $6,000 per game plus all their per diems and travel expenses. So you're making some good money out of this on the fall weekends, and I think there needs to be accountability first and foremost. And then we could talk all day long about should there be a National Collegiate Officials Association and they just assign guys out of there. I do understand having crews that work together because I think, you know, there's chemistry on an offensive line and I think there's chemistry among an officiating crew. Doug, I see you nodding your head as our resident coach. I'm very, very curious your thoughts on this and just maybe what you tell the team, what you would tell your team if they encountered a very similar situation.
So I do believe that there's absolutely chemistry among an officiating staff. Just this past Friday night, we had two brothers on the same crew, right? I absolutely believe there's so many dynamics in officiating in terms of where your eyes are after the ball leaves the line of scrimmage, where your eyes transition to, that I don't think you want to start to get into like a hodgepodge, handpick this guy for umpire, this guy for Lions judge, this guy's for the white hat. I don't think that solves any problem. I think that creates more problems. What I want to go back to as an offensive guy is that moment, that penalty, right? As an offensive coach, the reason all RPOs are so popular is our philosophy on the offensive side of the ball is make the officials call it. And how many RPOs can you bring up where offensive linemen are more than 3 yards downfield? There's a whole lot of them. But officials miss that call perhaps more than any call in high school or college football, outside of maybe holding. Holding happens on every play if you're an offensive or defensive line guy. You understand that. But what I found interesting about the substitution deal, right, is that you've got teams like Tennessee and USF that use the wide splits. I think the Sooners and Ben Arbuckle used that to their advantage and that they sent him out there. They sprinted him off like he was supposed to be coming off the field, and he stops right at where those wide splits guys end up. The number one receivers for those wide split deep choice teams, he ends up stopping there. And I think they probably played the rules a little bit. Like they found a way to use the rules to their advantage. They didn't have him that rule is in place so that you can't run a kid over to the sideline, act like he's talking to the coach at the sideline, and then he turns around and catches a touchdown, right? That's why that rule is in place. That's not what happened here. I think that coaching staff just found a creative way to find the gray area and utilize that rule and kind of expose it in a way.
So quick story about that. In high school, my junior year, we were going on the road to play our rival, and we knew we were heavy underdogs, so we need a little extra juice to stay in this game. So our first drive, we run that play, and it hits for a touchdown. We're going absolutely nuts on the sideline. We can't believe this worked. Oh, my gosh, we're going to actually compete with these guys. So we go up 7-0. Next thing you know, we're down 63-7.
So, you always have that 7-0 lead.
At least we got those seven. I had no idea. I'll hand up. I had no idea that was illegal until yesterday. And Oklahoma says that what they did technically was not illegal. I did not know that.
They changed that rule. They changed that rule within the last few years because of a similar one. It might have been Alabama involved in one, but I did know that they changed the rule this decade. They've changed the rule this decade.
I think it was a trick play to like Johnny Manziel or something, where he came over to the sideline, acted like he was talking to someone, and they got him with that.
Yeah.
And okay, I was going to say, because I know – within the last 2-3 years, I know Ole Miss hit A&M for that. And Johnny Manziel was long gone by then, but I saw that this offseason Ole Miss hit that. I mean, I was going to use that with my youth team at some point this year, but now I feel like Oklahoma burned it because there's so much awareness around that rule now.
What I would simply point out is that, well, the SEC saying appropriate action will be taken without further comment, that's such an arrogant statement. It drives me nuts. But secondly, and Doug pointed it out very well last Sunday morning, like that's a glaring blown call for the SEC office. I know Doug said it's a gray area. I can understand that you could interpret it as a technically legal play. The SEC office is very much saying it's not a legal play. And then, as Doug pointed out, the SEC officiating crew missed the tackle of the Irish defensive lineman Donovan Heinisch last week at Notre Dame on the 4th-and-goal play. And look, a holding doesn't mean the game's over. It means Texas A&M gets another try to get 4th-and-goal from the 21, which is a whole different, completely different ball of wax than 4th-and-goal from the 11. And so, again, that's two nationally ranked games, back-to-back weeks, where an SEC crew has blown a critical element. And I think you can't ignore that. And again, I can't ignore the fact that there's no accountability, especially at these highest levels of college football.
Well, two other plays from that game, you had the scoop and score that Auburn had that was wiped off, was ruled incomplete. And then you had on Oklahoma's final touchdown drive, ironically, all three of these controversial balls went to Isaiah Satania, passed on the sidelines where he does not survive the ground. The ball hits off him and practically bounces into the stands. And we've seen so many times where you could be outside the white, but if you lose the ball in the process of going to the ground, it's automatically ruled incomplete. This crew decided, yep, he caught that one, even though clearly he did not survive the ground with it. But they decided at that point, the play was over once he hit out of bounds, and the fact that the ball almost kicked into the stands didn't matter. Now, it doesn't mean Oklahoma went on. They were within field goal range, and Auburn didn't score again. So I'm not saying that decided the game, but it certainly helped.
Yeah, and it was bad enough. Last I'll say about it is the perception is that Auburn was hosed bad enough that somebody from Kentucky reached out to me about saying, man, Auburn got hosed today. So if Kentucky is feeling sorry for Auburn, holy moly.
Let's say that the 3:30 Eastern window, and here's a stat I saw. I think Dan Wetzel put this out there. So credit to him, ESPN guy. Michigan moved to 8-0 since 2023 under interim or acting head coaches. I'm going to say that's a college football record.
Gotta be.
I would think so. It's impressive.
Is it the I hate to harp on the negative here, but you're – Nebraska's at home. You're a year further along in your program than Sharon Moore and Biff Poggiar at Michigan. You have a quarterback that's a year ahead of his counterpart at Michigan, and Nebraska still finds a way to lose this game. Isn't the bottom line here for Nebraska that this program is average physically and soft physically and mentally? They're outrushed like 230-30, something like that yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I had picked Nebraska. Shout out to I know Zach, you picked Michigan. I can't remember who Doug picked, but this was one of those moments that Nebraska, in theory, had everything going for it, including the home crowd, and yet again, another sellout, testament to that loyal fan base. And you're right, they were atrocious running the football. They didn't have enough rushes for it to matter, and then they just couldn't get it done. And I just think that that's, well, I mean, they rushed it 31 times and averaged 1.4 yards per. So you're exactly right, but it continues. Like the first 2 years, you could say, well, Matt Rhule is trying to change it, but this is year three. You can't, to me, that doesn't fly anymore, especially again, as we talked the other day, in this era of college football, you don't get to talk about the long rebuild, because there's no such thing as a long rebuild. There's nonstop free agency in college football. There's more free agency in college football right now than the NFL.
I like watching this game as a Big Ten purist, because you had two teams that wanted to be physical and get under center and hand the ball off and play action. Bryce Underwood didn't have his best game. I think he only completed like 10 of 22 balls for just over 100 yards. Michigan scored on three explosive runs. One of them, a designed run by Bryce Underwood, where he just went untouched on a quarterback draw that was beautiful. But really, this game wasn't as close as the final score, the box score shows. You got to remember Nebraska got that Hail Mary at the end of the half. That adds 7 points there. So really, this is a 10-point ball game, not a 3-point ball game. Just looking at that.
Nebraska's lost six straight Big Ten openers and 28, that is two followed by an eight, consecutive games against AP top 25 opponents.
Yeah, that's a
I'm
broken.
not saying it's easy to beat an AP top 25 opponent, but there are plenty of teams that are ranked that are not, that prove to be average to bad football teams. And if you have a number in front of your name, Nebraska cannot beat you. And Matt Rhule is hired to change all that, and he hasn't so far. Speaking of changing a program, Indiana 63, Illinois 10. What can we say about this game that Kurt Cignetti has not already?
First of all, and I'm glad we got to this. I know JB's got a hot date he's itching to get out for, but had a question I wanted to pose to you. Number one, like watching Kurt Cignetti walk out of the tunnel as his team's kind of storming the field, he's the last one out, is the definition of coaching aura. If you guys, I'll try and put that in maybe the weekend leftovers, but I've got a serious question to pose to you two that I view as college football historians, right? That are your brains are full of information I can't even fathom, right? But what I'm going to say a statement, you tell me true or false, right? Is what Kurt Cignetti has done at Indiana with the Hoosiers the most impressive immediate rebuild in college football history? I said immediate rebuild, emphasis on immediate. Is it the most impressive immediate rebuild in college football history?
My initial, when you were phrasing the question, my initial answer was going to be Bill Snyder at Kansas State. However, it took him some, obviously due to the rules of the time, took him some time to get there. So, emphasis on immediate, I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, it's up there for me. I have two different thoughts on it. I'm glad you answered first, Zach, because it gave me a little bit more time to rack my feeble mind and try to come up with a good answer. Maybe Dabo at Clemson for what he did, like how quickly he turned them around and got them winning national championship.
Clemson wasn't near as down as Indiana was, and it
Well,
took him longer.
that leads me to my next point. This is not Kurt Cignetti rebuilding Indiana. This is Kurt Cignetti building Indiana. I think there's a difference there. Like it's not like Indiana had great heritage as a football program. Like all their stuff is mind your banners instead of mind your manners, because they have basketball banners. They haven't won a conference title, I think, since 67. So again, like he's not rebuilding, he's building Rome. And to his credit, yeah, I think it is. In this modern era, it is the best we've seen. I think yesterday's win was far better than anything Indiana did a year ago. And we know that Indiana, because it was drilled into our heads, never trailed in a game last year for the first 10 games of the season or whatever. Well, they mostly played high school teams and the worst Big Ten teams last year by the luck of the draw. But what they did to an Illinois team yesterday that prides itself on physicality, you know, that was like a scene from The Longest Yard when the inmates turn it on against the guards. Like that was just complete evisceration.
JB, I think you bring up a great point in that it is the building. It's not a rebuild because they weren't built before that. They had three winning seasons in almost three decades, 29 years before Kurt Cignetti got there. And Zach, I'm glad you brought up Bill Snyder because my Twitter mentions were blowing up with shut up. It's Kansas State and Bill Snyder. Bill Snyder went 1-10, 5-7. Then he had a 7-4 year, followed by 5-6. Then he won two straight years of nine games and then a 10-win season. So it took him a while to build it up, whereas as Cignetti and his staff step in, an immediate college football playoff. Now, we could have a whole nother pod on is it easier to build a team in this era than it's ever been. You could say that, but there's also something to be said about grabbing a bunch of dudes from all over the place and getting them to play together right away. So that in some ways it's easier, in other ways it's more difficult.
One more I would add to that, Kenny Dillingham at Arizona State, because remember that was a program that had been racked with NCAA scandal. It was a disaster under Herm Edwards and that crew. And so what Dillingham has done deserves mention in this conversation.
Fair.
It's going to be interesting to see what becomes. So I talked about this in our pod on Thursday. If this was a number 19 Michigan beating number 9 Penn State 63-10, you'd see Michigan jump into the top five. But because it's Indiana that beat Illinois, I'm going to be interested to see how the AP voters respond to this game. I've seen an SCP Plus this morning. Bill Connolly has Indiana, I think, in his top five. So the algorithms are responding. We'll see what the human voters do. And then I'm also interested to see what becomes of Illinois. We mentioned Nebraska not managing to find a way to beat a ranked team that sinks like a stone out of the rankings eventually, and that might be this Illinois team. They closed last year strong, and then they're ranked number 9 based off of that, and a Duke win that Kirk Cignetti said, well, if you watch that game, they didn't really beat them that badly. It was Duke turnovers. So now Illinois is certainly going to fall, and then they get USC at home on Saturday. So that's a team that's certainly capable of beating Illinois. So Brett Bielema has his work cut out for him coming into this week.
Yeah, USC didn't look overwhelming last night against Michigan State. Michigan State fought, so credit to Jonathan Smith's crew.
Let's go to South Beach. Miami took care of business against Florida. I picked Florida simply because maybe it was just penance because I was among those that thought this was going to be a playoff team or at least a playoff contending team. And I said, they're not going to go out this way. They're too good. And I guess they did go out that way. They scored 7 points and fell to 1-3.
Yeah. And, you know, like we alluded to earlier with Sam Pittman, Billy Napier, once again, super good dude. He is not long for the sidelines in Gainesville. He staved off the hangman's noose last year when they got cooking late and ended up with an 8-5 record and came into the year maybe as a winner of 5 games in a row, something like that. But that alleged momentum certainly hasn't carried over. DJ Lagway looks like he's regressed rather than progressed. And Billy Napier is an offensive dude, and this offense is hard to watch. Like, I was thinking about this when I was prepping mentally for the pod this morning. I want to see Florida's offense against Notre Dame's defense right now because they're both two of the worst units in the country.
So we're currently, all of us in the industry are on white smoke watch for announcements at Oklahoma State after what happened Friday night. We're not on one at Wisconsin after their AD came out and gave Luke Fickell the dread of vote of confidence. Florida has an off week before Texas comes to town in 2 weeks. JB, do you think it's possible Billy Napier is not coaching that game?
I'm torn on this because, again, I try to be real transparent here, and this has been pointed out to me by both coaches and front office type people over the course of this week who maybe are in situations where they know they're going to have to make changes or they're part of coaching staffs that are probably going to be changed. And they ask the question, why on earth do you fire a coach right now if you're four or fewer games into a season? Because literally your entire team could just decide to sit out in redshirt and go play somewhere else. And so I think maybe because of that, that UCLA and Virginia Tech last weekend will be outlier circumstances. And that we'll see maybe a couple more weeks of the season unfold before a bunch more firings. I think maybe that's the case, but it's hard to tell because everybody talks about how much it costs to fire a coach right now, but it costs so much more if you know that that person is not who you want to lead your program in the future. It costs so much more to hang on to them with the increased apathy of week after week, with the increased decrease in sales from concessions to merch to development dollars, anything you want. So I think we all know where things are headed in Gainesville and where things are headed in Fayetteville and where things are headed in Stillwater, but I'm not convinced that the timing is necessarily today that we see the conclaves convene in those respective college towns and decide it's time for a new football pope. And one more thing on Wisconsin AD, Chris McIntosh and him saying that. First of all, he kind of has to say that because he fired Paul Christ five games into a season. And that was a stunning move. And depending on who you talk to, he might have made that decision a bit emotionally because he and Chris had a verbal argument in the hours after a loss to maybe Ohio State and it happened. But he comes out and says that yesterday. Luke Fickell's 15-15 in 30 games atop Wisconsin. You can't just put your floaties on because all you're doing is treading water. And then they've lost seven straight games now to power conference competition. And then on top of all of that, they also still have left coming up. I'm blowing up our story about it. They still have left in the very near weeks, Michigan, Iowa, number one, Ohio State, number six, Oregon, number 19, Indiana, and number 9, Illinois, among their other Big Ten games. And they also close, I think, with Minnesota. Now, the rankings are going to change for Oregon, Indiana, and Illinois, but they're still all going to be top 15, top 20 teams when the new polls come out, and that's still left ahead for Wisconsin. So McIntosh is having to go out there and say, you know, I believe in the people around our program, specifically Luke, because of an atrocious start. And then you can look the double-digit losses too. They're not Arkansas in terms of not being able to get over the hump in one-score games, or Nebraska not being able to get over the hump under multiple coaches in one-score games. This is a Wisconsin team that, frankly, has become accustomed to getting blown out under Luke Fickell.
I think the other part that adds to the Luke Fickell the fire Luke Fickell chance is you've got a guy in Jim Leonard that would leave wherever he is. I know he's an NFL defensive pass coordinator right now. I can't recall exactly where, Broncos maybe.
Sounds right.
He would leave wherever he was to run back to his alma mater. So that certainly adds fuel to that fire. JB, I just want to jump in on something you said. I think with us talking to coaches and agents, I think we understand where their mindset is, but athletic administrators don't necessarily think in that same vein. They're thinking in terms of how can we fundraise, how can we raise money, how can we rally support, all of those things. They're not necessarily front of mind on roster turnover, and whereas coaches, like, you're going to have to rebuild everything taking over one of those jobs. So that's it's just two different mindsets there with the decision makers.
No, you're absolutely right. And hopefully some of the decision makers are truly making these decisions because they believe it's best for the student athlete, because that's what it should be. It should be about the student athlete. But now more than ever, you cannot ignore the finances of college athletics and specifically college football, because everybody is legally getting paid. And the last thing I would say about Wisconsin is, in addition to having lost, I think, seven consecutive to FBS Power Conference opponents. They've lost their two games this year to Power Conference foes, Alabama and Maryland. One of those is not like the other, but they've still lost those two games by a combined 65-24. Again, that's just non-competitive.
Oof. All right, we're 40 minutes on the dot into this. JB has a hot date. So each of you guys give me one game that we have not mentioned that you want to talk about.
I'm not sure if I've got one. I had a couple things I wanted to throw out there and say, and I'm I know JB had one. I'm not going to steal that one, right? But I do want to say in the game that JB is going to talk about, Sean Lewis's snapback mesh trucker hat tan lines are absolutely epic. That's going to be in the weekend leftovers. But JB, I'll let that be your lead into that game.
Yeah, if you listen to this pod, and we know we do have some devoted listeners, and we thank you, you know that I'm a longtime believer in Sean Lewis, and you know that I was bullish on this San Diego State team going into the season. As bullish you can as you can be while also saying you think a team can win 6-7, maybe sneak away up to 8 games, probably not 8. But San Diego State entered the year with a Vegas set over-under of 4.5 wins. They're halfway to 4 right now after an absolute dominant performance against the Cal Golden Bears of Justin Wilcox last night. For as good as San Diego State was in a 34-0 victory, Cal was bad. And Cal is supposed to be a team that could make noise this year in the ACC. And instead, they go on the road within the same state to a upcoming Pac-12 rebirth member and just got absolutely embarrassed. 34-0. There was nothing flukish about that game. San Diego State, they were scoreless after the first quarter, and then San Diego State put points on the board every quarter thereafter. They dominated this contest, a massive win. Excuse me, I thought the Aztecs were 2-2, but they're 2-1. They were coming off of a bye week after a really, really ugly, disappointing loss at Washington State, where that game was close early, and then they just completely melted down. And instead, they made the Cal Golden Bears melt down all night long. And they held Cal under 300 yards total offense, even though Cal has everyone's favorite quarterback in Sagapola Tele. And he had an okay game, but he threw two picks. He completed less than 50% of his passes. The other game that I didn't tell you I was going to shout out that I have to shout out that was unfolding last night as well, Troy Trojans. My guy Jared Parker and the Troy Trojan, their offensive line coach Caleb Carbine and Reiner on staff there, some really good dudes. They were down 17-0 on the road in Buffalo. And, you know, it was Chris Berman who said nobody circles the wagons like the Buffalo Bulls. But the Troy Trojans circled the wagons and get a 21-17 win a week after having been beaten pretty soundly at home by Memphis. And that came a week after they led Clemson 16-0 on the road and then ended up losing 27-16. So Troy coming off of back-to-back games of really difficult circumstances and being down 17-0 on the road outscores Buffalo 21-0 to win the game.
Hey, I do have a few quick notes before we hop off, right? Delaware, first-year FBS program, improved to 3-1. They beat FIU 38-16. Kansas absolutely thumps West Virginia. Rich Rod, we can't figure out who those Mountaineers are right now. There was no hard edge in that game. JB, I'm still going to give you credit for your one bold prediction. If Kansas goes on to win the Big 12 title, you were just a year early with your big prediction. And then I think Western Michigan got in the win column with a big win, going for a 2-point conversion against Toledo to win, and that points their ticket in the win column. So that was a good win for Lance Taylor and the Broncos.
Yeah, a good win and a much needed win for Lance Taylor and the Broncos, because there've been some disappointment with how things were going for Western Michigan. And great point for you on Delaware. Ryan Cardy, coacher of ball. They've got a great staff there. Carico Wright, former Clemson star defensive back, coaches their secondary. Delaware's got it popping right now. You're right.
I'm going to continue to mention this team as long as they remain undefeated. That is, of course, the North Texas Mean Green. Went to Mikey Stadium, got up 28-7 in the second quarter. We're up 10 with 10 minutes to play and needed overtime to survive Army. They're 4-0 in the season, 2-0 on the road, and 2-0 in overtime. All right, that's it for the Sunday edition of the Football Scoop podcast. We will be back Tuesday with hopefully a full roster. Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.